If you've not seen it, you should Google the Rolling Stones album cover for their 1986 release, Dirty Work. It's quite an album cover. It features the Rolling Stones wearing bright red blazers and yellow pants on a pastel green sofa. But what it really features is the Rolling Stones saying, "Hey, we aren't some has-been band from the 60s, we are totally modern and 80s. It happened a lot in the 80s. Bob Dylan is wearing an awful blazer on the cover of 1985's Empire Burlesque. George Harrison looks awful on the album cover to 1987's Cloud Nine. Aretha Franklin's doing a duet with George Michael. Jagger and Bowie dancing in the street. Look, apart from that last one, I don't even really think the music itself was that bad. It's more the way the Rolling Stones were trying to cash in on what's the latest trend. But can you blame them? Because it actually happens a lot. Blondie tries rapping, Rod Stewart covers Oasis, David Bowie works with Sonic Youth, and Elton John did quite a good old country album in the late 2000s I could tell you about. Artists wanted to stay relevant. And like anything else, there was a local version. Jimmy Barnes goes grunge on the cover of Juice Magazine number 1. Whatever this Australian alternative 90s thing was, it was also big news. Triple J, The Big Day Out, Juice Magazine, Recovery, Channel V, it was a huge audience. And if you were around before all this was new, if you were an older established musician, would you be able to don the red blazer of relevance and try to get onto this new scene? Well, that's what this episode is about. It's about Australian artists and bands from another generation going alternative to varying results. I mean, what better way to look at the culture than to see how it was co-opted? Every artist here had long careers, and there's so much more to say about how they began, how they became legends, and what they did after. None of that is here. This is just how some legendary Australian musicians coped in the 90s. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week, we look at legends going alternative. I didn't know it at the time, but the divide between this new Triple J Australian alternative scene and the existing rock scene was quite big. At the start of the 90s, it was one or the other. If the mainstream radio stations and TV shows didn't want to know about hard-ons, so too did the hard-ons not care about the mainstream. These indie bands were often new and they didn't really need a leg up supporting the bands of the last decade. They more often supported other new bands, either locally or from abroad. Tumbleweed and the Meanies supported Nirvana, not Crowded House. Triple J bands didn't need Crowded House and Crowded House didn't need those Triple J bands. There were exceptions. There were concerts like the Big Backyard Fundraiser in 1994, which featured Midnight Oil as well as Tumbleweed, The Cruel Sea and The Clouds. INXS, whose management was involved in the label Ruart, took Ratcat on a big tour. But Ratcat were forced into being some commercial band, which just wasn't who they were as people. And I don't know what the Midnight Oil audience thought of Tumbleweed. So for the early part of the 90s, the two scenes were pretty separate. This Australian scene had a lot of similarities to Britpop, but Britpop loved the recent past. Those bands loved The Jam and The Smiths. Oasis famously said they were finishing the job started by The Lars. Australian musicians of the 90s Triple J era were less enamoured by the recent past. This new batch of Australian bands seemed to want to kill their heroes. It was just another culture. When The Big Day Out in 1996 was struggling to find big acts, they didn't call Midnight Oil or INXS. There was a commercial old guard on one side and the alternative kids on the other. I won't speak for anyone else, but I had plenty of time for both Tumbleweed and Midnight Oil. But as a teenager, Tumbleweed belonged to me and my friends, and not ugly older people. There's just that silly ownership of music that you have when you're a kid. It all leads up to 1996 for me. The majority Australian band Crowded House announced that they were breaking up. Crowded House was loved by everyone. They had 22 charting singles and were constantly on the radio. Their latest release, Recurring Dream, was a best-of compilation that would sell 13 times platinum. That's about 1 in 20 people owning a copy, including babies, infants, prisoners, and everything. As a final gig, the band organised a free concert at the steps of Sydney's iconic Opera House. It was a big deal. The concert was announced for Saturday the 23rd of November 1996, which was shit for me because I was rostered on at my job at a local supermarket pushing trolleys. But the night before, the rains came and the concert was pushed back a day to Sunday the 24th. I was able to go. Fate had been kind. But I know people who went the other way, unable to make the Sunday, but had planned to go on the Saturday. Sucked into those people. The Sydney Opera House is 10 minutes or so walk from the nearest train station, Circular Quay. I went with my brother and my cousin, early, because I wanted to see all the support bands. Also, I was a teenager with nothing else to do. We rode the train to Circular Quay, and when we got there, my brother had to use the station toilet, and we told him we would walk ahead and meet him closer to the Opera House. We were so early, there would probably be no one else there. And we would just use pre-mobile phone voodoo to find each other. I didn't see my brother again for another 12 hours, because no one expected some 200,000 people to turn up. Thousands upon thousands who thought they turned up early were turned away. They spread themselves in the nearby public parks, and lucky folks on boats lined the harbour. Looking at the photos and the footage of the day, the scale is unbelievable. There's no official final attendance number, but I can tell you that every single area of the Opera House steps and the surrounds were covered with people. They were all there to see Crowded House and were not likely to get rowdy, apart from one kid who was famously called out on stage by colourful music promoter Michael Chugg. Me and my cousin James stayed in our spots for 12 hours. I don't think we drank or went to the toilet. I'm not sure how it worked, but it was the 90s. We just stayed there. It could be the largest gig ever in Australian music history if the estimates of like 250,000 are to be believed. I loved Crowded House to the point of being a member of their fan club, Friends in the Ends. But I also wanted to get there early because the lineup of support bands were amazing. Crowded House had chosen pretty much the three hottest bands in alternative music to support them: UMI, Custard, and Powderfinger. This wasn't the way it had to go. There were plenty of more conventional commercial rock bands that would have supported Crowded House. Crowded House could have given the supports to plenty of old friends from the 80s who were still playing. I'm sure bands like Baby Animals and Hunters and Collectors would have been thrilled to play. But for some reason, Crowded House decided to go alternative, which meant that the crowd who got there early was a Triple J crowd, who wore band t-shirts and treated it like it was a big day out, but at the Australian Home of Opera. They were moshing and stage diving at a Crowded House concert. At least they were for the supports. And remember, Crowded House was breaking up. They had no reason to court a new audience. Powderfinger opened proceedings playing songs from their recent breakthrough album Double Allergic. They were followed by Custard playing songs from their recent breakthrough album Weisenheimer. I had never seen either of those bands before, and I imagine that was true for most of the crowd. You probably never even saw them on TV, but both were fantastic. Then came UMI. It was the biggest crowd they would ever play to because by the time they got on, it was packed. No more people could get in and no one was leaving. UMI played their big hits. They had two number one albums at this point and they had swept the ARIA Awards. People knew who they were. Even at 16, it felt like it was the changing of the guard. Here was this massive band who was breaking up, and supporting them was this band who was starting to have hits. Songs like Mr. Milk sounded great in a stadium-sized crowd. It showed to me, at least, that UMI could work easily as a stadium band. I kind of figured that's where they would go. The production teams filmed all the bands, mainly to show them on the big monitors on the side of the stages. They were ready to dump all the footage of the support bands at the end of the day. Word got around and the bands themselves salvaged the tapes. There's a few clips on YouTube of the support bands. I think 1996 is where the crossover starts. Rightly or wrongly, a couple of thoughts started to emerge. One, that maybe the old guard could tap into this new Triple J crowd. And two, there's no reason why these alternative bands couldn't be the next multi-platinum big rock bands. And suddenly, two worlds collide. Why UMI and Custard were on that bill has not been revealed. In interviews, Neil talked a little about liking these new bands. But one of the reasons Crowded House were breaking up was because Neil Finn felt trapped in his own band. He wanted to experiment and try something different without the pressure of keeping the multi-platinum train going. He came back in 1998 with a solo album called Try Whistling This. The title right there is a line in the sand for likability. Compared to Crowded House's impeccable songs, Try Whistling This was twisted and strange. The first single was a song called Sinner, backed with a minor chord spooky groove and a prominent sample. It was mixed by Nigel Godrich, who would work with Radiohead and Travis. Here's Sinner by Neil Finn.
See it, anyone? Got my eyes, got my face. Sing it, everyone. Got my nose, got my blood. Conscience plays on me now. Safe until my luck runs out. Cuckoo's call, pendulum swings. Thought you knew everything. Lift my hands, make the cross. Sinner, I have never learned. Beginner, I cannot return. Forever I must walk this earth like some forgotten soldier.
Triple J picked up Sinner. He even did a live version for that radio station. It ended up on a compilation, and there's Neil alongside Silverchair and Friends or Rom. Neil and a new band also did a one-hour recovery special, playing 9 songs from the new album. Odd thing was, commercial radio picked up Sinner as well. Not like massively, but he was still loved enough in Australia. The album got to number 1 in the charts, and Sinner just cracked the top 40 at 40. But it didn't crack the Triple J Hottest 100. The second single was by far the most poppy and conventional song on the album. She Will Have Her Way took Neil Finn back into the commercial radio airwaves in a big way. And the follow-up album, 1-0, was a conscious effort to try and break America. Although the launch of that album would be huge shows in New Zealand that featured members of Radiohead, it was captured on the live album 7 Worlds Collide. But by then, alternative rock was kind of dead, and Neil became a much more interesting and experimental artist, but that's another story. Try Whistling This remains one of my favourites. Previous to this, when Australian mega bands broke up, their singers fell away and sometimes ended back at the RSL circuit. But Neil managed to find a much more interesting road as his older songwriter like Rufus Wainwright or Amy Mann. Try Whistling This was quietly that reinvention, and the Triple J crowd gave him a bit of a safety net. I would give a lot for a vinyl reissue of this album. From Neil Finn's Try Whistling This, here's the lovely hypnotic title track.
Tales from my head, can't buy the book. No one's listening, but I guess you could. Try whistling this. You say you're tired, liquid as water. As I stroke your back, I'm the best that you know.
The three big rock bands in Australia in the 80s were AC/DC, Midnight Oil, and Cold Chisel. They all dealt with the red blazer of relevance in different ways. Let's start with Midnight Oil, as they were the most active in Australia at the time out of the three. They are an incredible band, and their story is so epic, and they did so much important work in the 80s. They were already 6 albums in by the time we get to them in the 90s. The band was always political, and they always stood for something. And Australia in the 90s was a time of huge political upheaval. Midnight Oil's early 90s albums were chart toppers. Then 1996 saw the release of their album Breathe, their 6th top 3 album in a row. It had a very odd album cover, all dark and moody. Inside it was stripped back and raw. Without the slick production, commercial radio didn't really care for the record. But Triple J started playing a song, Surf's Up Tonight. For a band known for their fiery politics, Surf's Up Tonight was just a sweet, romantic mood song. It made it to number 75 in the Hottest 100 of 1996. Here's the lovely Surf's Up Tonight by Midnight Oil.
Wherever the wind blows, when it blows over the sea, sitting high, waves will rise. What a shame.
But then came the follow-up, 1998's Redneck Wonderland. At the time, Australia was divided on many issues. We were still reeling from a damning 1996 report about the government's role in stealing children in Indigenous communities. The revelation was greeted by outcry and calls for the government to apologise. Prime Minister John Howard refused to say sorry. Another issue was the proposed uranium mine at Jabiluka in the Northern Territory. The site was home to generations of Aboriginal people and features some of the oldest cave art on the planet. Again, there was outrage as locals and Indigenous groups held a blockade in 1998. And of course, there was the rise of the far-right One Nation Party, led by Pauline Hanson. Her isolationist, anti-Asian rhetoric was being broadcast everywhere. So it's not a surprise that a band like Midnight Oil was fired up in 1998. But it wasn't just about fighting the good fight. For the Oils, they wanted to get back to making music that agitated and kicked against the mainstream. They looked at what young bands were doing and they were inspired by the industrial rock of Insurge, whose lyrics were also very political. They even took Insurge on tour in 1997, and they saw that the overly produced albums they made at the start of the 90s was at odds with where rock music was going. To update their sound, they worked with Magoo, the Brisbane producer who worked with Regurgitator, and wanted to mix those raw guitars with an intense modern sheen. The resulting album took its name from a piece of graffiti that the band saw on the street. It said the words, Redneck Wonderland. The title track announced a very different Midnight Oil. That track wasn't produced by Magoo, but it featured a trippy drum sample with very heavy guitars. Here's Redneck Wonderland by Midnight Oil.
I don't wanna run, I don't wanna stay, 'cause everything that's near and dear is old and in decay. Emergency has gone, apathy rolling on. Time to take a stand, Redneck Wonderland.
The band hit the road. They recorded a Triple J live at the Wireless. They appeared on Recovery to preach to the kids in a memorable performance. Singer Peter Garrett is striking at the best of times, what with being 4 metres tall and bald. But on this kid's morning TV show, he wore a bright red suit that's only feature was the nuclear radiation icon. They set up big white walls and invited the audience to write messages on them. Garrett himself wrote the phone number for a Jabiluka hotline for kids to call and get more information. The band also joined the blockade at Jabiluka. They performed a concert for the protesters along with Regurgitator and the Aboriginal band Coloured Stone. All of it worked to some degree in getting their message to the kids. Redneck Wonderland snuck into the 1998 Hottest 100 at number 96, but the album was their first in many years to not go top 3. They wouldn't release another album for 4 years, and they would break up shortly after that. Redneck Wonderland, sonically, would prove to be a one-off. For me, the things Midnight Oil did around this time stand out more than the music. The album felt cut and paste and sampled, which is fun and cool, but it took away from the raw power of one of the greatest rock groups that we have. The other single from Redneck Wonderland was White Skin Black Heart. It's even more dance and beat driven, with a film clip of flashing lights in a warehouse that looks very odd. It looks like a Silverchair film clip. Still, another important anthem by an important band. Here's Midnight Oil with White Skin Black Heart.
What you gotta do now, now that you started? What you gotta do now, now that it's done? Your words got out there, they're floating around and coming right back down. You're gonna leave us lying here, dealing with the consequences.
The great Cold Chisel were broken up at the start of the 90s. Their frontman Jimmy Barnes had a successful solo career. I covered it in the Juice magazine episode, but the very first issue of Juice magazine had a very unintentionally funny cover about Jimmy Barnes going grunge to promote an album that just had a little bit more guitar than his previous ones. Barnes was really going through some tough times in the 90s and escaped to France for several years. What brought him back to Australia was a Cold Chisel reunion. The thing about Cold Chisel was that everyone could write songs. so every member had songs that they had collected for many years. Plus, they wrote some new ones on top of that. The sessions were sporadic and they worked with a series of younger, hot producers. They worked with Tony Cohen, who produced The Cruel Sea, and Dave Graney and Tism. They worked with Paul McKercher, who produced Clouds, Tumbleweed and Spiderbait. And they worked with Kalju Tanuma, who produced Insurge, Friends or Rom and The Mavises. The resulting album was called The Last Wave of Summer, and it has a lot of wonderful moments, but it's too long and lacked an overall focus. Still, their reunion was big news and Cold Chisel were more than happy to go on Triple J to do interviews and even perform live. The tour saw lots of new bands get support slots like The Foves and Finiscad. Unlike that, Cold Chisel didn't do a big comeback single that was right for radio. They did the very indie thing of releasing a strange new track and didn't even make a film clip. It's loud, bawdy and fun, and it was the only song that Triple J picked up. With a bit of a push, it could have been a Living End song. Here's Cold Chisel with Yakuza Girls. Paul Kelly was played on Triple J in the 80s. Kelly had a lot of commercial hits in the 80s as well, but as Kelly himself said, Triple J would play his album tracks and B-sides. By the 90s, Kelly wasn't having commercial singles anymore, but continued his singing and songwriting about Australian life. He had a bit of a Triple J hit in the form of Last Train, his own older song covered by Christine Arnoux, a young backing singer from the Torres Strait Islands, who worked with bands that included Neil Murray of the Warumpi Band. Her version of Last Train, released in 1993, was very much of the time. It had a 90s dance beat, a 90s rap. Kelly provided a bit of vocal like a sample. Look, it hasn't dated terribly well, but it did get to number 61 in the Triple J Hottest 100. Here's Christine Arnoux and Paul Kelly with Last Train. Kelly spent the 90s experimenting with country and reggae and whatever else tickled his fancy. He was also one of the first of the old guard to really complement the alternative music scene. He would talk about these bands in interviews and he wore a UMI t-shirt in a photo shoot. He appeared on Recovery twice, once in 1996 to perform a little song he wrote that he just threw out on an EP. It was called How to Make Gravy, and in the almost 20 years since, it has become a Christmas classic. The song started life on a fundraiser CD for the department store Maya Grace Brothers, who put out a Christmas CD every year. Kelly had the good sense to take it back and release it under his own name. It's since become a film, which is weird. It's also become his most popular song. The other time he went on Recovery was to promote his 1998 album Words and Music with the single Nothing on My Mind. The band featured pretty much all of Rebecca's empire, with Rebecca Barnard sharing vocals with Kelly on some tracks. Spencer P. Jones from Beasts of Bourbon was also involved. Rebecca's Empire were always such pro musicians and they lived in Melbourne, so it all made sense. Kelly just worked with who he thinks is good. Nothing on My Mind sounded incredible and a far cry from Kelly's thoughtful acoustic strumming. It has a propulsive beat and a loud, fuzzy guitar. It's spoken word and weird in a great way. Here's Nothing on My Mind by Paul Kelly.
Rack 'em up, Jim, it's your break. Set 'em up, Max, it's my shot. You know, I really could go around all three. You wouldn't believe the crap I've had to deal with this week. And I'm shoveling most of them for free. Grace under pressure, that's what the old man said. Well, the old man said a lot of things in his time. Oh, fighting the bull's one thing, fighting bullshit's another. Just walk on and on.
He would have one bona fide Triple J hit in 2000 with a song called Every Fuckin' City. It got to number 9 in the Hottest 100 of 2000. The song was about a backpacker in a relationship losing themselves from European city to European city. In a short, simple song, he weaves heartache, globalization, the Australian backpacking world, and a lovely melody into a killer song. It was a live track, a final song on a 4-track EP and a bit of a throwaway. But Triple J plays his album tracks and B-sides. I think the Triple J audience was the future backpacker audience anyway, and the song had a naughty word, so it all clicked. I have gotten drunk in many European cities thinking about this song. Here's Every Fucking City by Paul Kelly.
We argued on the Channel train to Paris. The Van Rouge helped us make it sweet again. But by the time that we got down to Lyon, everything I said was wrong, and you cursed me in the rain. We split up for a while in Barcelona. We met up 6 days later in Madrid. I was hoping that the break would make things go a little better for us, and for a little while it almost did. Now I'm in a bar in Copenhagen, and I'm trying hard to forget your name. And I'm staring at the label on a bottle of Cerveza. And every fucking city feels the same.
Like Paul Kelly, there were a couple of other 80s bands who had big hits but seemed to share a lot of what made the 90s so 90s. Top of the pile for me are the Hoodoo Gurus. They weren't sad sack post-punk, they were quirkier, weirder and fun. They were a band that Triple J loved in the 80s and they fit well with the 90s. They didn't change their sound or too much about themselves and were still a Triple J staple. Oh yeah, drummer Mark was the brother of Triple J presenter Richard Kingsmill. Guitarist Brad Shepard was a big rock nerd who loved this new guitar rock scene. He would hang out with UMI and he would produce albums by the Welcome Mat. Their song Waking Up Tired made it to number 83 in the Triple J Hottest 100 of 1996. It's a wonderful slice of pop rock. Here's Hoodoo Gurus with Waking Up Tired.
Oh, the nights are long and I'm so tired of waking up tired. Man, they just drag on and I'm so tired of waking up tired. The company I'm keeping won't let me get my sleep in. Oh, I hate the light and I'm so tired of waking up tired. The morning sun is getting way too bright and I'm so tired of waking up tired. If I was worth a fortune, I'd never leave my bedroom. I just wanna stay right here.
But the Gurus broke up in 1997. In 1998, Dave Faulkner formed Antenna with Kim Salmon of The Scientists and Beasts of Bourbon. They only released one album and one single from that album. It was called Come On Spring and it made it to number 64 in the Hottest 100 of 1998. The lead vocals were by Salmon and it was much more lush pop than anything that either men had done. I guess it worked for the Triple J crowd. Here's Come On Spring by Antenna.
Rising from a winter.
Brad Shepard formed his own band. They were called the Monarchs, and they were inspired by the Detroit rock of the Stooges and MC5. In the band was Greg Hitchcock, who was in UMI, and Andy Kelly, who was in Glide. They released one album of in-your-face rock called Make Your Own Fun. The first single, released in 2000, was called 2001. The 90s were dead, baby. Here's the Monarchs with 2001. Hunters and Collectors were also an 80s band who had the odd hit, but felt fine sitting in with the Triple J scene. They were another Triple J 80s band. Their 1993 single Holy Grail made number 54 in the Hottest 100 of that year. But it's really Throw Your Arms Around Me that transcended everything. The song was released on the band's 1986 album Human Frailty, and it made it to number 2 in the first two Triple J Hot 100s, where it was all time, and then number 4 in the third year. In 1998, Triple J ran an all-time list again, and once again the song came in at number 2. Comedian and TV presenter Paul McDermott made it to number 31 in the regular Hottest 100 of 1998 with a cover of that song, which he performed on his show Good News Week. So the song was heard all over Triple J at the time. There are other classic songs on that 1998 all-time list, like Cold Chisel's K-San was at 94 and Crowded House's Don't Dream It's Over is at number 76. Those are just massive Australian classics that would have a chance on any list. But Throw Your Arms Around Me coming in at number 2 meant that the core Triple J crowd loved the song. Here's Throw Your Arms Around Me, the Paul McDermott version, just for something different.
I will come for you at night time, and I will raise you from your sleep. I will kiss you in four places as I go running up your street. And I will squeeze the life out of you, and you will make me laugh and make me cry, and we may never forget it. You will make me call your name, and I'll shout it to the blue summer sky. And we may never meet again, so shed your skin and let's get started.
Hunters and Collectors broke up in 1998. On their final tour, they took the Fauves and the Whitlams to various shows. The guitarist from Hunters and Collectors, Barry Palmer, went on to form Dead Star. That band featured Carolyn Kennedy, singer in the Plums, and Peter Jones, who was in the final lineup of Crowded House. They would also be joined by Crowded House bassist Nick Seymour when that band broke up. Now, I really love Dead Star. They released a great album in 1997 called Milk. They were signed to Mushroom. They had three people who had been in multi-platinum ARIA award-winning bands. They weren't supposed to be an indie band, but they wielded guitars in 1997, so what else can you do? The single I've Got Something to Tell You is wonderful. Again, let me stress how much I love the band, but the film clip looks like the parody of a grunge film clip. It's the band in a public toilet stall that is covered in graffiti. It's all odd colours, out of focus, and jerky camera moves. It's like someone decided they should make a film clip like Veruca Salt might do, but 3 years earlier. It screams, "Hey kids, do you like rock music?" What was the pitch to the band? I see you guys and a public toilet all together. It's bad and I hate it. Google it and have a look. But the song is great. Here's I've Got Something to Tell You by Dead Star.
Far away from the canvas,
And not all of Milk is like this. It was just that one film clip, which was also released in the UK. The band also appeared on Recovery around this time, and that's when I first heard of them and fell in love immediately. Carolyn Kennedy's voice and look were a 1-2 pop rock punch. For my money, she has one of the top 5 voices of the era. They also played the 97 Big Day Out. The single Don't It Get You Down got to number 70 in the Hottest 100 of 1996. It had a much better film clip as well. Here's Don't It Get You Down.
Well, don't it get you down, wondering how it ever got to be this way. And you know, it ain't the first time. And now you're on.
Nick Seymour left after a while. He said that he found it hard to come down from being in a big band like Crowded House and to be slumming it again. Maybe making him stand in a cramped toilet covered in graffiti wasn't the best idea. But Dead Star continued, and even better was their next album, Somewhere Over the Radio, released in 1999. Like Milk, it was self-produced. But by now, the shadow cast by Nirvana was starting to lift. Alternative rock was something else altogether. Dead Star just made an excellent, timeless pop record. And they went on Hey Hey It's Saturday this time, not Recovery. No red blazes of relevance. Deeper Water made number 74 in the Hottest 100 of 1999. Here's Deeper Water by Dead Star. But the band broke up. Mushroom went through major changes and Dead Star lost the label support. It felt like they were all set to release 3 more singles and be massive. But instead, with no deal, they folded. They just weren't an indie band who could step back down to the pubs. They were a construct made to play for the big time. And they were great for it. They just didn't make it. I would love for these albums on vinyl too, thank you very much. Especially that third one, Somewhere Over the Radio. Here's the final ever Dead Star single, released in 1999. It's my favourite, probably. Here's Over the Radio by Dead Star. If there was one person who changed their sound in the 90s and made it work, it was Kylie Minogue. Kylie was eager to shed her soap star pop image by the mid-90s. She had made 4 albums in 4 years with the pop producers Stock, Aitken and Waterman, but she decided to leave them and signed with an independent UK label called Deconstruction, although she was still tied to Mushroom back home. In 1994, she released a self-titled Kylie Minogue. In searching for a new sound, she had worked with UK indie dance band Saint Etienne and even looked to work with people involved with Primal Scream. None of that made the finished album, but this was Kylie going for indie cred. You can see it on the album cover to Kylie Minogue. She wasn't the girl next door anymore. The first single, Confide in Me, was a hit on Triple J, coming in at number 30 in the 1994 Hottest 100. Here's Confide in Me by Kylie Minogue. Kind of worth noting that Kylie Minogue was younger than Tex Perkins or Simon Day, and she was only a year older than Tim Rogers. She's very much in this generation of artists. In 1995, she did a duet with Nick Cave, Where the Wild Roses Grow. She would perform with Cave at the Big Day Out. But 1997's Impossible Princess was where she really went for it. She took over as co-producer for the first time. She worked with the hard-rocking Welsh political band Manic Street Preachers. She was inspired by people like Garbage and Björk. Again, she couldn't look more unlike the girl next door on the memorable album cover, although the album would have to change its name after the death of Princess Diana. One of the big hits from the album was Did It Again, making it to number 81 in the Hottest 100 of 1997. It's full of attitude and electric guitars. Here's Kylie Minogue with Did It Again.
Clever girl, think you are, but you think too much. Clever girl, think you know, but you don't know much. Try to make a move, go to a different door. You know it's all in your head. You better put that business to bed. By your fair hands, a design you met with.
I really loved the Impossible Princess album, but it wasn't very successful, and like Midnight Oil's dalliance with Alternative, it turned out to be a one-off. Kylie would soon toss away the red blazer of relevance for famous shiny hot pants. She would dive into dance pop, and the distortion pedals were never heard from again. Which is a shame, because Impossible Princess was a lot of fun. Imagine Kylie Minogue fronting a hot rock band. It would have been cool. Here's the other big single from that album, and it's my favourite. Here's Some Kind of Bliss by Kylie Minogue, written with the members of Manic Street Preachers.
Yeah.
And finally, let's talk about AC/DC. AC/DC did not give a shit about trends. They released two albums in the 90s, The Razor's Edge in 1990 before Nirvana was a thing, and 1995's Ballbreaker. They didn't change their sound. They didn't work with indie producers. They didn't get alternative bands to support them. They were just AC/DC. The single Hail Caesar made it to number 97 in the Hottest 100 anyway. Bands seem to like to do AC/DC covers though. Dave Graney covered Show Business. The Hard-Ons teamed with Henry Rollins to do Let There Be Rock. Tex Perkins fronted UMI for a one-off single, a cover of Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. And TISM did a cover of For Those About to Rock in 2020. In 1995, right in the middle of the decade, there was an AC/DC tribute album called Fusebox. It featured, amongst others, Front End Loader, Spiderbait, The Meanies, Regurgitator, and Friends of Rom. Everyone just loves AC/DC. Here's The Meanies version of Long Way to the Top, which even had a film clip. As a kid, for me, it was sometimes weird to see these old people on my TV shows. I remember seeing New Zealand indie legend Chris Knox on Recovery and wondering why the bloke from the local pub was on TV. He played Not Given Lightly, one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard, by this weird old man. My first encounter with the Saints was on Recovery, and God, they looked awful. It took me years to actually get into the band after seeing that appearance. But it also took me a long time to understand the appeal of Rod Stewart. I never knew he was more than just another old guy who hung out with Bryan Adams and Sting. But this was the era, and I was a teenager. I just wanted music that was mine. I wanted to see bands that I could relate to. But these older bands wanted to get to me as well. I love all the bands in this episode. I went back and explored what made them great. I don't know if any of them did their best work in the 90s, but maybe just breaking through a little was enough. And of course it all passed. Kylie went dance, Midnight Oil returned to their rock ways, and AC/DC remained AC/DC. But these legends flirting with alternative music, Triple J and Recovery, showed just how big these years were. Anyway, to end, here's that Chris Knox song I first heard on Recovery. Chris is from New Zealand, and he's a seminal artist in their indie scene. He released this song in 1989, and is considered one of the greatest songs from New Zealand, certainly from their indie scene. I should have been too young to discover this song at 17, but the world works in funny ways. This song would be episode 1 of Just Choice, a theoretical podcast about the 90s New Zealand alternative music scene, whatever that means, bro. Here's Not Given Lightly by Chris Knox. Me, show me your eyes, your love, most tender feelings, and I'll give you mine, be truthful. And revealing, cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love. It's love not given lightly, but I knew this was love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Just Ace. This is the end bit where I talk about how you can help the podcast. And this week, I want to give another plug for the book. The Just Ace book is out now, and it adapts the first two seasons of the Just Ace podcast into book form. It's not just the podcast scripts, it's been entirely re-edited to work as a book. I know a lot of people who are interested in stories about this time in music history, and some people are just not podcast people. People who have helped me with the podcast are not podcast people. Well, hopefully they are book people. They can now get all the stories and drama and nerdiness in book form. If you know someone who wants to know more about Oz music in the 90s, and they are not a podcast person, then this book is for them. It's available on Amazon, and the buy links are in the description. I'm working on getting a few into record stores as well. Follow me on social media and on the website for announcements on stockists. People have also posted photos of the books when they turn up, and they've tagged me on social media, which is unexpected and very nice. The book is the first of two volumes, and I'm pretty thrilled by the reaction so far. It got to number 1 in music history books on Amazon, which is also unexpected. And if you did buy it on Amazon, a 5-star review on there would help immensely. Links are in the description. Okay, there are other ways to support me, like the Patreon or the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee. There's also the merch store where you can buy t-shirts and tote bags. Plus, there's no cost ways of helping, like just leaving me a review on Apple Podcasts, following me on social media, and simply telling a friend. I appreciate any help you can give to spread the word. Okay, that's it. Next week, a band that's even weirder than you remember.
Hi, this is John from Fove's Other Best People. We review each and every song from legendary Australian rock group, The Fove's. From Misguided Modelling Career to Dogs Other Best People. From Celebrate the Failure to Simon Tahiti. Are you a fan of The Fove's? Give Fove's Other Best People a spin. Available from wherever you get your podcasts, and at fovespodcast.com.